Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
There's going to be a growing need and demand for mediation because negotiation has become the primary form of human decision making.
Listeners of IDN will need no introduction to William Urey. If you take any negotiation course in the world today, you can't help but notice how it has been touched in some important way by one of his works. Techniques developed by Urey are sometimes quoted as standard tools of negotiation, such as BATNA, go to the balcony, or reframing issues. Urey is one of the pioneers of interest-based negotiating. He is co-author with Roger Fisher of Getting to Yes, perhaps the world's most popular text on negotiation with over 8 million copies sold in more than 30 languages. His subsequent books include Getting Past No, The Power of a Positive No, and The Third Side. He is the co-founder of the Harvard Program on Negotiation, a senior fellow of the Harvard Negotiation Project, and a member of the Advisory Council of the International Mediation Institute in The Hague. In this episode of IDN, Urey discusses what he views as the inevitable emergence of mediation as a global profession and how in recent years he's been active mediating some of the hottest and most difficult conflicts around the globe. I started the interview, however, by asking about his professional roots of doing field research in anthropology.
I went into anthropology because I was curious about human nature and the human story. And anthropology was the most open, expansive subject. It was a license to be curious. And, of course, when you look at human behavior, one of the primary forms of human behavior is conflict.
Right.
Conflict and cooperation. And so that's how I ended up. I was trying to apply anthropology to some problem in humanity. And one of the big problems, of course, is how do we deal with our deepest differences? That's what led me into the field of mediation.
And it was medical anthropology, though, that you started off with.
Yeah, well, it was medical anthropology. It was philosophical anthropology. Yeah. I did my master's in medical anthropology on a group in the New Guinea highlands. But it was everything. It was economic, political, legal. Yeah. That was the thing about anthropology. You take any subject, you make it an adjective, you put it in front of anthropology, and you have a field.
In the New Guinea highlands, did you see how they resolved conflict?
I did go to New Guinea at one point, and there's a vast variety in New Guinea.
What was the group that you studied?
The group was called the Fore.
Fore.
But I also visited different groups in the Semai in Malaysia, for example, who are one of the most peaceful peoples on earth.
Right.
New Guinea, they tend to use a lot more war. I spent time with the Bushmen in the Kalahari. Looking at the way in which they resolve disputes, because I was really curious to see how some of the simplest societies on Earth, who resemble more or less the way in which
we evolved.
At least they give us some clues.
Yeah.
Because you know, for 99% of our time on this planet, we were hunters and gatherers. We lived in small groups, and the
small autonomous bands.
How did we deal with our differences?
Did you find a lot of variation in styles or ways of resolving disputes among the different groups you were studying?
I did. There is a lot of difference, and there's something universal behind it, which is which is something I came to call the third side, which is that we tend to see, at least in our Western culture, we tend to see every conflict as two-sided. You know, there's one side versus the other. And what we don't perceive is there's always a third side, which is the larger community, the friends, the neighbors, the onlookers, the allies, the relatives who surround the parties. And often the key, what you find in every society, is some form of third side. Among the San Bushmen of the Kalahari, for example, whenever tempers start to rise and two individuals or two groups start to get in conflict, everyone circles around. Someone goes and hides the poison arrows out in the bush.
So people can't hurt themselves.
But the whole group kind of self-organizes around this, and they all sit around in a circle, all the men, the women, sometimes the children, and they talk and they listen to each other for days on end until looking for what's going to be the solution to this. And it's not just that they stop at a solution. there also has to be a reconciliation. The relationships have to be healed. And so they have a whole system, a very kind of intricate
system. And you found this sort of universally among the smaller groups that you were with, that they all had
make use of the community somehow to help contain the conflict, to help resolve the conflict, or even to prevent differences from arising.
You know, it's interesting. I did an earlier podcast a year or so ago with a guy who studies the Machichinga. He's a medical anthropologist, and the way they resolve conflict is with a very stoic society. They try not to have conflict, but they periodically get together as a community, mm-hmm. and they resolve conflict through song, through drinking and mm-hmm. song is the approach. But
right.
it sounds like that's also another approach
sure.
to community resolution.
Exactly. Through song and through also, for example, the Bushmen, I noticed that, you know, during the, you know, with particularly difficult conflicts, they would at night do a kind of dancing.
Right.
So a kind of trance dancing, and they would have visions and ask, you know, the gods for help in helping to heal the differences within the group.
And that takes you up into, you went from there into... you said into coal mines.
Right, exactly.
Natural progressions going
right.
from the
right.
the highlands of New Guinea into a coal mines in Kentucky.
In Kentucky, right, exactly. Now, yeah.
Was that a direct flight? Or?
Well, I was looking for real practical experience. Yeah. You know, anthropology, the basic methodology is called participant observation.
Right.
You observe, but you're also a participant. And so I got this opportunity to get involved with my friend Steve Goldberg in a very bitterly divided coal mine in Kentucky, where there were wildcat strikes, there were bomb threats, people were packing guns. The National Union was concerned this was going to lead to some kind of nationwide coal strike. The judge had gotten involved. He had jailed the workforce. I mean, it was kind of out of control.
And you came into this as a medical anthropologist?
I came into this as an anthropologist with Steve was an arbitrator, and so they knew him as an arbitrator. They said, "Can you come in and sort this out?" And he realized it wasn't a matter of arbitrating this. You couldn't arbitrate this. This needed to be mediated, and so he invited me to come along. And I ended up spending, you know, 3 or 4 months down there in the coal mine, getting to know the miners, trying to understand what the system was, how were they dealing with differences. And then how could you begin to transform the way they dealt with their differences?
And did it get transformed? Was that,
it did, actually. Yeah? It did.
How did it get transformed? What was the...
Well, I mean, basically, the main form of dealing with differences in that mine was walking out. If ever there was a foreman got into a tussle with a miner or whatever, the miner would empty out his canteen, which was a signal that he was leaving, and then everyone, there was a rule of solidarity, everyone would leave the mine at that point. And what we introduced was, how about talking it out rather than walking it out? Wow. But the thing is, the miners didn't really believe that management would listen to them. No one really believed in the possibility of actually having a dialogue, working things out, trying to solve the problem. Trying to listen to each other, and that's what.
How'd you get them to do that? What was the trigger? What led you to introducing that change?
Well, I think it was. Partly it was a lot.
It sounds easy to say this. Why don't you just talk it out instead?
A lot of it was listening to each side individually, because they wouldn't even sit down and talk to each other.
So they allowed you in.
And you actually had to build trust and credibility over time. I mean, particularly,
sounds like
management
training
was
as a
one
mediator.
Thing. With the miners, it was more difficult. You know, I went through hazing. I mean, you went, you know, under the mine. You know, they thought I was they didn't know what I was, but there was a lot of distrust. And so it took a while to build credibility and trust, go fishing with them, to build that and listening to them. And then when an incident arose, to kind of shuttle back and forth, and then eventually to bring the parties together and say, hey, can you work this out? And then they discovered that they could work it out and that it was a much better solution for them, and then try it again and try it again until it became more of a habit.
And did that endure over time?
Endure over time. The wildcat strikes, which were going on once or twice a month, fell off to zero within about a year. They went through other points too. It's not
a relationship as complex.
Exactly.
It's going to come up.
Exactly. But it actually did work out for them.
So that sounds like a great introduction to the power of mediation, about how you're building trust, you know, getting people to show that you can lead them to other solutions that are not always zero-sum games.
Right.
Yeah. Was that your first sense of that mediation might
sure.
be something?
Yeah, absolutely. It was that, and I was looking for anything. I was mediating small claims for a local judge who's had a big backload, and just to try to learn the practice. And so I was working as an anthropologist, I was working as a mediator, I started working as an arbitrator in the coal mines too, because I got hired as an arbitrator, so I got a little bit of sense of what it was like to be an arbitrator.
So before you got to negotiation, really, you were in mediation. I mean, I guess you developed the tools or the skills,
right.
actually on a practical level, you know, using them for real disputes.
That's it.
Yeah. And you've today, before we talk about some negotiation aspects, but or ideas, you're still very active in mediation.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Well, particularly internationally, that's my passion is particularly difficult situations, war situations.
Right.
So I've been involved in the years, you know, former Yugoslavia and Chechnya, in Venezuela, in Indonesia.
And you're doing the same things that you're doing in the coal mine, or is, you know, building trust, trying to.
A lot of it is that.
Can you give an example of one that you've done recently?
That
you can talk about.
Yeah. One of the more recent ones, I've been working in Colombia. I've been working, one of the more recent ones was in Venezuela, where there was, back in the early 2000s, there was a really tense standoff between the supporters of President Chavez and the opponents. And there'd been a coup d'etat, he'd been reinstalled, there was a lot of fear of violence, there were a million people on the streets of Caracas in favor, a million people on the streets opposed. There was some violence. There were a lot of fear that this was going to escalate into a civil war.
Between two Venezuelan groups.
Between two Venezuelan groups. Right. It was a political violence. And they were worried that it was going to turn into a civil war.
Who invites you into this situation?
Well, I was in.
Because you're an outsider.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was invited in. I was asked to go there by President Carter, actually, who had been invited by both sides to see if he could be of help. And the UN was also involved, and the Organization of American States. So, and they were asking, they said, can you come in and help, you know, build a third side, which is kind of build a kind of a community within Venezuela, a community that would be for the peace of Venezuela. And so I came in giving talks and workshops for both sides or bringing them together. And the two sides weren't even used to coming together in the same room. There was a lot of tension. But it eventually graduated to me working personally with President Chavez and the leaders of the opposition, trying to get them to trying to diffuse the acute disrespect and distrust that was tipping the situation to in the direction of violence. And I was working with the Carter Center with my friend Francisco Diaz.
And you have a resolution there, or something that's workable as a result of being able to dialogue with both sides.
Yeah, it's never perfect, but essentially what we did was we reduced the tensions so that it didn't tip in the direction of a civil war. And we worked out ground rules for a referendum so that it could be settled by the ballot rather than by the bullet.
And you're also active also in the other areas of mediation. You've done some work, for example, with the International Mediation Institute, IMI. You're on our legal advisory council with Lord Wolf and others. There's also a sense of competency, standards. A little bit about where do you see the mediation field now, where it's going?
Mediation is I think we're still in the infancy of mediation. I mean, in the longer run, it's something. I mean, in one sense, it's the oldest human technology for dealing with disputes is the use of third parties, the use of what I call the third side. On the other hand, we have to reinvent it for the needs of today. And the field of mediation is relatively young.
In most countries, it's very young. It's just barely being introduced, if at all, in many parts of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we're just beginning to professionalize it, to think about standards, to think about competencies. To a lot of people in the world, they don't know the difference between mediation and arbitration.
Right.
For example, they think a mediator comes in and tells people what to do.
Right.
Or they don't know the difference between mediation and meditation.
Actually, you do a Google search, you get a lot of hits on meditation.
Right.
So most people would agree we are internationally pretty much in the infancy of mediation. You see it growing over time? You think it would will take off?
Without question.
Yeah. Why? Why?
Well, because these days conflict is a growth industry. And
well, it always has been.
But I'd say it's even more. And what's happening to me is we're living in an era I call the, I like to think of it as the negotiation revolution, which is that maybe a generation or two ago, the principal form of making decisions was very much top-down, hierarchical. The people on the top of the pyramids of power make the decisions, and the people on the bottom follow them. And that was true whether in the family, in politics, at work. And because of the knowledge revolution, those pyramids of power are gradually being flattened into organizations that resemble more networks of right. negotiation, which means that now you can't just go to a third party and get an order. You have to resolve it amongst yourselves. And so oftentimes you're not able to resolve it amongst yourselves, which is why you need to be creative and think about maybe using assistance like a mediator.
Right. Right.
And so to me, there's going to be a growing need and demand for mediation because negotiation has become the primary form
right.
of human decision making. And oftentimes with negotiation, you end up with an impasse. What do? A mediator is a very attractive alternative.
It's interesting. It sounds to me as if you would, based on your view of where the world is going, would say that mediation, the growth of mediation, the adoption of mediation, is almost an inevitable next step. That it accompanies with it's going to have to accompany this growth.
Right. There's no question about it. And you're seeing it in informal ways in the judicial system, outside of the judicial system. But it's
inevitable. Mediation will grow. Who knows at what rate?
Right.
And it'll become more. It'll have to become more professional. The way the practice of medicine is.
Right.
You wouldn't go to a doctor
right.
today that
right.
it doesn't have a license or isn't
sure.
competent. You probably within 20 years you'll want a mediator who's
yeah.
you know has similar qualifications.
And people are beginning to see that. Yeah. You know, to see that, you know, like for example, in the family in the family arena, like with when there's marital conflict
right.
or divorce.
Right.
People now, at least in the United States, think, okay, you know, I don't necessarily have to go to court. I can go to a mediator first, or I can get a mediator. It's beginning to become a category in people's minds. And I think in the corporations, too, people are beginning to realize that, hey, you know, going to court is just too costly. It is just, it's going to damage the relationship. There's got to be a better way to deal with these things.
Hardest case that you've ever had to deal with, but that you found a solution to, what would you say?
That I found a solution to. Because
your desert island
is a hard case.
Yeah, I know. your desert island case, if you had to take the one dispute to a desert island and write about it, what would you?
I don't know. You know, I mean, you know, starting with that coal mine, you know, people thought that was absolutely impossible. But, you know, since then, Venezuela was also a situation where we were able to get the parties to back off, where again, people gave us very low odds. And I must say, just generally speaking, you know, when I started working in this field and you looked at, you know, there was a Cold War.
Yeah.
And that was going to go on forever. The Berlin Wall was going to be there forever. There was the war in South Africa. You know, blacks and whites were going to be killing each other forever. In Northern Ireland, you know, Catholics and Protestants. And one thing that's impressed me is the number of times that people said that conflict is absolutely impossible, and yet through patient, persistent negotiation, mediation, right. things yield a solution. Right now, I'm working in the Middle East, so I'm a kind of a sucker for
you
lost
really
causes.
Are, you really are an optimist.
You have to be. That's the only way you can get anything done in this.
But you know, it's interesting.
I mean, the pessimist may be right, but only the optimist gets something done.
Or the pessimist would say they're a realist, but
right.
if the world were made by realists, we wouldn't get up in the morning,
right.
I think, is the... But it's interesting, you hit on something which I think in my practice occurs to me a lot, because in my job people ask me, what do you think of this dispute? How's it going to come out? And one of the things that you can never predict is what's going to happen in the world, what's going to happen in life. You know, the thing that you cannot take a snapshot at the beginning of any dispute and say the world is going to be, the world of your dispute, the world of your community, you may not even be alive at the end of when this thing gets resolved. I mean, there's so many things that can change, and that there will be opportunities along the way to find resolution. You will not know at the beginning of a dispute. So it's interesting that it sounds like your hard cases, they may have been also influenced by just the world going on in the meantime, as well as the as the efforts that you've had in trying to resolve them. But can you think of a concrete case? I mean, what would you call that? Maybe the coal mine. Maybe that was the one. It doesn't have to necessarily have been the hardest, but it might have been.
It was one of the hardest. You know? No, I mean, these
but
guys.
But for you,
were,
for you at the time.
Yeah, for sure. It was. Yeah. I was just tossed into that situation. They were using violence. Bomb threats is a very serious thing in a coal mine. They were rough and tough. I was, you know, I was just from outer space as far as they were concerned. So it was a baptism by fire into the field of mediation.
So we get now into the negotiation area where obviously you're very well known. You probably have people coming up to you in restaurants saying, can I negotiate the bill with you? Or where do you see the trends these days in negotiation theory and negotiation training? What are the sexy cutting edge topics right now that you see?
Well, one is, you know, negotiation in an era of, you know, of globalization, which is where you're dealing across many different kinds of cultural differences, and you're having to bridge all kinds of cultures. That's definitely one, I'd say, cutting edge for the field. The other is really complex negotiations where you have many, many different parties. It's not just two parties, but many parties. Oftentimes, you have very little time to make decisions, or you're dealing with situations that are just that seem intractable. That in fact, negotiations that can go on for years, like the Middle East, you know, as an example, where you have to think of it. My colleague Jim Sabanias thinks about them as negotiation campaigns. You know, where they're long. There are many, many different negotiations. Yeah. Many, many different, quote, battles in a long, prolonged effort to try to transform a situation. Because to me, that's the key in negotiation, is that in this world, it's not a question of whether we're going to have conflict or no conflict.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of conflict.
The only question is, are we going to handle the conflict in a destructive way through violence, through you know, a lot of long, ruinous lawsuits, through ruinous strikes, or are we going to find better, more efficient, more creative, more constructive ways of dealing with a conflict through dialogue, through negotiation, through mediation, through all of the different forms of ingenious interaction that we can find between human beings? And to me, the survival of our species, of our human experiment, really depends on our ability to crack that problem, because we have the technology nowadays to, you know, for huge destruction. And the question is, are we going to evolve the creative technology, the software of human relations that will allow us to deal with our differences in constructive ways so that we can give our children a better life?
Well, this may take us way far afield, but that's the key of the Drake equation. I don't know if you're familiar with the Drake equation.
No.
It's the theory of whether or not life exists elsewhere in the galaxy or the universe. You take just the galaxy and Carl Sagan did a wonderful illustration of this in the old Cosmos series they did, but Frank Drake was an astronomer at Cornell, or is an astronomer, I think, still today, in the 60s. He postulated that you take how many stars there are, and then you say 200 billion in the galaxy. You say, how many of those are likely to have planets? I mean, maybe say 10%, but still it's a huge number. It's 10 billion, or 20 billion. How many of those planets are going to have you be in the Goldilocks zone, you know, between where you actually can have liquid water and have life evolve? How many of those planets actually do have life evolve? And you take it down, and how many ways you do this? You know, you have life will evolve, then will intelligent life evolve? And depending on the numbers you run, you can wind, you know, with thousands, or it's hard to get to zero, right, in terms of intelligent life evolving. But then the last question is, how many of them don't self-destruct once they acquire technology? It's actually, you know, it's the last question in the Drake equation is, how many intelligent civilizations, you know, can they survive beyond having evolved the ability to acquire destructive technology?
That's it.
And so that's the end game.
Yeah, that's the race. I mean, we're engaged in this race now between our ability to create ways of destroying ourselves and ways of creating abilities to live with each other.
The field
of mediation is in that question of, can we figure out, can we use our ingenuity, can we use our human spirit, our human heart, our minds to devise better ways of dealing with each other? We're inventing jet airplanes and all computers. Can we invent better ways of dealing with each other?
This may be a bit too much of a statement, or going a little bit too deep, but I think the sort of area, the space that you're occupying today, the things that you are doing, you know, will help answer the question is, will our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren be able to meet other intelligent civilizations that have survived, that have made it beyond that ability?
That's it. And as an anthropologist, that's what I like. You take the long sweep. And right now, in human history, we've been around for, a couple million years as a species. The dinosaurs were around, which we think of as the classic extinct species, were around for 150 million years. If we get to 150 million years, we'll be, the way things are going right now, we'll be lucky. So the question is, how do we do this?
I did an earlier, they did last a long time. People forget they went extinct because, they're probably going extinct anyway, but I did an earlier podcast with a paleontologist, Kevin Pabian, at UC Berkeley, who's an expert on Tyrannosaurus Rex. Uh-huh. And believe it or not, the fossil record suggests they probably had ways of getting along, that they worked cooperatively, they hunted in packs, at least the juveniles.
Sure.
So if you want to survive, you're going to have to figure ways of even if you're a T-Rex, you've acquired that ability. You got to get it.
Every animal, cooperation is, we look at a lot of competition in nature, but there's a huge amount of cooperation that allows this to take place. And human beings, we are the cooperative species. We don't think of it. But maybe in the future we'll be homo negotiator. I just think that this is one of the most exciting fields you could go into, because I think it's an expanding field. It's still in its infancy. It's waiting to be invented, to be created, and to me, it's essential to the future of humanity.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.